Chapter 22. Flying to the Philippines had taken Cabrillo and Franklin Lincoln a little over 14 hours. Getting from the capital, Manila, to Tubigan on Bohol Island, in the center of the 7,000-plus island archipelago, had taken almost as long, although the distance was a little more than 300 miles as the crow flies. Juan knew from experience that the proverbial crow rarely flew in third-world nations. Because ground transportation couldn't be guaranteed on Bohol, they had been forced to first fly to nearby Cebu Island and rent a sturdy, if aged, jeep and wait for the ferry to take them across the Bohol Strait. Link had remarked that the ferry was so old, the tires slung over her rusted sides should have been white walls. The boat had a pronounced list to starboard, despite being loaded intentionally heavy on the port side. Any thought of sleep during the crossing was nixed by the tractor trailer lashed next to their jeep, loaded with pigs that suffered mal de mer even in these sheltered waters. The smell and their squeals were enough to wake the dead. Twice during the crossing, the engines inexplicably went silent. The first time was for only a few minutes. The second lasted nearly an hour, as crewmen under the eye of a snarling engineer tinkered with the machinery. Worrying about surviving the trip was a welcome distraction for Cabrillo. It allowed him to stop dwelling on Max's fate for a while. But when the engines belched to life again, his thoughts immediately returned to his friend. The irony wasn't lost on him that Hanley's own father had died in the Philippines, defending Corregidor Island in the opening months of the Second World War. Juan knew that Max would do whatever it took to protect both his son and the corporation. The man had a sense of loyalty that would make a St. Bernard proud. He could only hope that they would find the leverage needed to ensure Max's freedom. He had no illusions about the methods Zelimir Kovac would use to extract information. And if Max couldn't hold out, once he started talking, his life was forfeit. That thought ran like a loop of tape through Cabrillo's mind. As the lights of Tubigan finally resolved themselves, Juan's satellite phone chimed.
Cabrillo?
Hi, Juan, it's Linda.
Any word yet?
Nothing from Severance, if that's what you're asking.
Damn.
Yes, it was.
10 calls to the director of the responsivists, and still nothing. Juan had posed as the head of the security company supposedly hired by Max to rescue his son. He'd spoken to the receptionist enough to know she read romance novels during her lunch break. She had apologized each time he'd called, stating that Severance wasn't available, and patched him through to voicemail. Juan had offered any reward Severance wanted for Max's return, and when that didn't garner a response, he'd started threatening. His last call had warned Severance that if Max wasn't released unharmed, he was going to come after his family. It was an empty threat, thanks to Langston Overholt, but Severance didn't know that. Nor, it seemed, did he care.
What's up? Cabrillo asked.
Kevin just finished up with Donna Skye. She doesn't know anything.
Is he sure?
They talked for an hour, Linda said in her pixie-like voice. She's just an actress who belongs to a loony cult. She's too high profile to be directly involved with anything untoward. And according to the celebrity scandal rags, she's tied up shooting her new movie for at least the next 4 months, apparently to the chagrin of her latest paramour, who's in Australia touring with his band, which, by the way, Mark Murphy says sucks.
Then I'd probably like them, Juan said, digesting this latest piece of information.
If Gil Martel didn't say her name when he was talking to Severance after we broke into his office, then it has to be something else. Can you ask Holly to go over that tape one more time? He cursed up a storm when I told him he might be wrong, and then volunteered to listen to it all again. Tell him he gets an extra ration of grog. Anything else? Eddie's back from Rome, and we're getting good audio on the arms dealer's yacht, but nothing pertinent so far.
Cabrillo had completely forgotten about that mission.
Okay, good. Keep me posted.
Link and I are about 3 hours from where the responsivists have their Philippine retreat. We'll keep you posted.
Roger that, Chairman, and good hunting.
Oregon out.
Juan clicked off the phone. "The whole Donna Sky thing's a bust?" Link asked in the darkened confines of the Jeep. Wearing all black, Link was just a large shadow sitting next to Cabrillo.
"Yeah, she doesn't know anything."
It was a long shot anyway. Woman like that can't take her dog for a walk without the paparazzi following her.
"Linda said about the same thing," Juan said moodily. "I should have realized that.
Chairman, we've been grasping at straws since the beginning. No need to get all morose on me now. We go with the intel we have and see where it takes us. Dead end or not, we have to check it all."
"I know," Juan agreed. "It's just
that Max's butt is on the line this time," Link finished for him. "And you're concerned." Cabrillo forced a tired smile.
"That's putting it mildly."
"Listen, man, this is our best lead yet. There were 400 responsivists here for God knows how long, and now they're all dead, most likely so they'll never talk about what they were doing. We'll find what we need and get Max and his son back."
Juan appreciated the pep talk, but it did little to make him feel better.
That would come only when Max was back aboard the Oregon and Tom Severance and Zelimir Kovac were nailed to the most convenient outhouse door. The ferry staggered into the harbor, slamming into the wooded pilings in one of the worst displays of seamanship Cabrillo had ever seen. 10 minutes later, with the boat secured to the dock and the ramp lowered, Link fired the Jeep's engines and they eased onto the quay. They immediately opened the windows to dissipate the pig smell that had permeated the vehicle.
"Good a time as any," Juan said, and put his foot up on the dashboard.
He rolled up his pant leg. The prosthesis he wore was a bulbous, ugly limb of flesh-toned plastic. He pulled the leg free and unlaced his boot, pulling it and his sock free. There was a tiny hole in the bottom of the prosthetic foot. He plucked a small Allen wrench from his pocket, inserted it in the hole, and turned it counterclockwise. This released a mechanism built into the leg that allowed him to split open the calf like an old-fashioned lunchbox. Cached inside what he called his smuggler's leg were 2 Kel-Tec pistols. Despite its small size, the Kel-Tec fired P-rated 380 caliber bullets. For this particular mission, the armorer aboard the Oregon had hollowed out the 7 rounds each pistol held and filled the voids with mercury. When the bullets struck flesh and slowed, the momentum would cause the mercury to explode out of the round and shred tissue the way a shaped explosive cuts through a tank's armor. A hit anywhere center mass was fatal, and even a glancing shot to the shoulder or hip would sever a limb. Cabrillo handed one of the diminutive pistols to Link and slipped the other into the small of his back. A small block of plastic explosives and 2 detonator pencils, set at 5 minutes, were also in the smuggler's leg. Juan had found over the years that when his prosthesis set off airport metal detectors and he pulled up his cuff to show the limb, he was waved through with an apologetic smile every time. Although they hadn't encountered any bomb-sniffing dogs on this run, he was ready for that contingency with a small bottle of nitroglycerin pills and an explanation of having a bad heart. The road out of town and into the hills hadn't seen new asphalt in decades. The responsivists had worked on the opposite side of the island, and it took an hour to reach the area. The sun had crested the horizon during the drive, revealing primal rainforest and jungle that hemmed in the road like a continuous emerald tunnel. The few villages they passed were composed of a couple of crude thatched huts and the old corrugated metal lean-to. With the exception of the Japanese occupation during the war, the pace of life in this part of the islands hadn't changed in millennia. When they were 5 miles from their destination, Link pulled off the road, easing the Jeep into a thicket of underbrush deep enough to hide the vehicle. They had no idea if the responsivists had left guards at their facility and weren't going to take unnecessary chances. He and Cabrillo spent a few minutes putting finishing touches on the camouflage and erasing the tracks the Jeep had sunk into the soft soil. Even knowing where it was hidden, neither man could see it from the road. Juan built the small cairn of pebbles on the verge to mark the location. Shouldering packs stuffed with gear, they stepped into the jungle and started the long walk in. The sun seemed to vanish, replaced by a green filtered glow that barely penetrated the high canopy of trees. The color reminded Cabrillo of the Oregon's moon pool at night when the underhull lights were turned on. Despite his size, Lincoln moved through the jungle with the easy grace of a predatory cat, finding the tiniest openings between the dense vegetation so as not to disturb anything. His feet seemed to barely brush the loamy ground. He was so stealthy that the background symphony of insects and bird cries never dropped in volume or rose in alarm. Cabrillo walked in his wake, constantly scanning behind them for any sign they were being followed. The air was so humid it seemed that his lungs were filling with fluid with each breath. Sweat ran freely down his back and soaked the band of his baseball cap. He could feel it cold and slick where his stump met his artificial leg. After 2 hours of stalking silently through the rainforest, Link held up a fist, then lowered himself to the ground. Cabrillo followed suit, crawling up next to the big seal. They were at the edge of the jungle. Ahead of them was open grassland that stretched for a quarter mile before dropping to the sea in a line of near-vertical slopes and eroded cliffs. With the sun behind them, Cabrillo didn't worry about reflections off his binoculars as he scanned his surroundings. The responsivists had built a single metal building a short distance from the cliffs. It was as large as a warehouse, with a gently sloped roof to deal with the 13.5 feet of annual rainfall. Opaque panels in the roof would let in diffused sunlight, as there were no windows. The sides were bare metal painted with a red oxide anti-corrosion paint, and there was just a single door facing a parking lot big enough for 50 or so vehicles. About 30 yards from the warehouse were four rows of rectangular concrete pads. Cabrillo counted 40 of the empty pads per row. Link tapped him on the shoulder. He drew a rectangle in the dirt and pointed at the warehouse. Then he made a second rectangle and pointed at the field of concrete. Cabrillo was with him so far. Then Link drew a much larger square around the whole compound and pointed across the open field. Juan studied the area through the binoculars and noticed a slight variation in the grass, which ran in a straight line before abruptly turning 90 degrees. He looked at Link. The Navy vet placed the edge of his hand on the line he'd drawn, indicating he thought there had once been a fence running the perimeter of the field. He then used his fingers to rather crassly raise the corners of his eyes. Cabrillo nodded his agreement. This had once been a Japanese compound of some kind, most likely a prison camp. The fence had been removed years ago, and all that remained of the cell blocks were the concrete pads. He wondered if the responsivists chose this location because there was already an existing foundation for their building. The duo watched the structure for another 2 hours, passing the binoculars back and forth when their eyes began to tire. Nothing moved in the clearing except when a breeze blew in off the ocean and made waves ripple through the knee-high grass. Juan suddenly cursed and stood. "That's it. Nobody's home." His voice seemed unnaturally loud after so many hours of silence. "How can you be so sure?" Link asked in a hoarse whisper. "Listen." His tone made it clear he was angry with himself. Link cocked his head. "Nothing but the ocean hitting the base of the cliffs." "Exactly. See the empty brackets on the roof? It's got to be 90 degrees out here, which means it's at least 120 in that building. Those brackets once held some pretty big air conditioning units. They took them when they bugged out. Unless that building is packed to the rafters with water, a guard detail wouldn't last an hour in there, let alone the weeks it's been since they abandoned this place." Cabrillo held out a hand to haul Lincoln to his feet. It was a testament to Juan's time working out aboard the Oregon that the effort didn't tear the muscles in his back. Although he was reasonably certain of his deduction, they approached the structure carefully, keeping well away from the door until they were tight up to the metal side. The building's skin was hot enough to singe Juan's fingertips when he touched it. With their pistols drawn, they approached the door. Juan set his pack on the ground and fished out a length of rubber tubing. He wrapped it around the knob and handed one end to Link while he kept the other. They stood on opposite sides of the door, and Juan pulled at the tubing. The friction of the rubber against the metal knob caused it to turn, and the door clicked open. Had it been set with explosives, Cabrillo's trick would have kept them well out of the blast radius.
"Not even locked," Link commented. Juan peeked inside. "No reason it would be. Take a look."
With pearly light shining through the skylights, the warehouse remained murky, but there was enough illumination to see the vast interior was completely empty. There weren't even support columns for the roof trusses to break up the monotony of the expanse of concrete. If not for the small door, Juan would have thought this had been an aircraft hangar. The floor had been painted a uniform gray and was spotlessly clean. When Juan stepped inside, he caught a trace scent of bleach.
"Looks like the Merry Maids beat us here, huh?" Link joked as he stood at Juan's shoulder.
Cabrillo remained silent. He knew in his heart that they would find nothing to incriminate Severance, so there would be no leverage to get Max back. The responsivists had removed any hint of what had gone on inside the building. The air conditioning ducts were gone, all traces of wiring and plumbing, everything. "Waste of damn time," he finally said in disgust. Link was hunched down, examining the floor. He straightened, saying, "This concrete is pretty weathered. My guess is that it was laid by the Japanese when they built the rest of the prison."
"Why the hell would they need such a large building?" Juan wondered aloud.
"The ground's too hilly for an airstrip, so it's not a hangar."
"I don't know. Storage of some kind."
"A factory," Juan said. "I bet they used prisoners of war as slave labor here. God knows they used them everywhere else they occupied." Link touched the tip of his broad nose with his finger.
"Bet you're right."
Juan grabbed his satellite phone and dialed the Oregon. With Holly working on the audio from the bug, Juan asked the on-duty communications staffer to plug him through to Eric Stone.
"What's up, boss man?" Eric asked when he answered the phone in his cabin.
"Do me a favor and check into the Japanese occupation of Bohol Island in the Philippines. I'm interested if they had any prisons or factories set up here."
"What, now?"
"You can plan your assault on Yanni Dahl's honor later."
"Okay. Hold on a second."
The connection was so clear he could hear Eric's fingers tapping furiously at his computer terminal.
"I've got something. There was a prison for indigenous criminals opened on the island in March of 1943. It was closed the day MacArthur made his return on October 20th, 1944. It was overseen by something called Unit 731. Want me to run a check on that?"
"No," Juan said. It was 118 degrees in the building, and Juan shivered, the blood in his veins suddenly turning to ice.
"I know what that is."
He killed the connection.
"This place was a death factory," he told Link, "operated by an outfit called Unit 731.
"Never heard of them."
"Not surprised. Unlike the Germans who apologized for the Holocaust, the Japanese government hasn't really acknowledged their own war crimes, especially Unit 731's.
"What did they do?"
"They had factories and laboratories set up all over China during the occupation and were responsible for Japan's biological warfare efforts. There are some estimates that claim Unit 731 and others like it killed more people than Hitler did in his extermination camps. They experimented on prisoners by subjecting them to every virus known to mankind. They engineered bubonic plague, typhus, and anthrax outbreaks in several Chinese cities. Sometimes they used aircraft that sprayed the landscape with disease-ridden fleas or packed them into bombs. Another favorite trick was to take over local waterworks and intentionally contaminate a city's drinking supply."
"They got away with it?"
"For years. Another part of their job was to determine the effect of explosives and other weapons on the human body. They would gun down, blow up, or incinerate hundreds of prisoners at a time.
You think of any torture imaginable, and I guarantee Unit 731 tested it thoroughly. I recall one experiment where they hung prisoners by their feet just to see how long it would take them to die. Link had gone a little pale under his ebony skin.
And this place was one of their laboratories? He asked, looking around.
Juan nodded.
And the local Philippine prisoners were the lab rats.
You thinking what I'm thinking?
That Severance chose this place for a very specific reason?
Using a toxin on the Golden Dawn after its people were working at an old germ warfare factory can't be a coincidence. Just throwing something out there, but is it possible they all contracted something left over by the Japanese?
It wouldn't have killed the crew all at the same time, Cabrillo replied. I thought of that as soon as Eric mentioned Unit 731.
Now, it has to be something they created here. Do you think it's a bright idea to be walking around without a biohazard suit?
We'll be fine, Juan said confidently.
Man, I'd settle for a surgical mask and some rubber gloves, Link groused. Try one of Linda's yoga techniques and breathe through your eyes. Using flashlights and starting at opposite corners, the men examined every square inch of the building. There wasn't so much as a gum wrapper on the floor.
There's nothing here, Juan admitted.
Not so fast, Link said. He was studying the warehouse's back wall. He tapped one of the exposed steel support columns. It sounded tinny. Then he placed his hand against the metal siding. It was hot to the touch, but not scalding. That in itself didn't prove anything, since the sun might not shine directly on it, but it was an encouraging sign.
What have you got? Juan asked.
A harebrained thought. Come on. He turned and started for the door, counting his paces as he went. 98, 99, 100, he said as he reached the opposite wall. 3 feet per step, so we've got us a 300-foot-long building.
Great, Juan replied with little enthusiasm.
Ye of little faith. Link led Cabrillo outside and paced off the exterior wall, again counting each step. 98, 99, 100, 101.
You unintentionally shortened your stride, Juan said flatly.
Touch the back of the building, Link said, knowing what the chairman would discover. Juan yanked his fingers away. The metal was scorching hot. He cocked an inquiring eyebrow. The columns we saw on the other side of this wall aren't load-bearing. The metal is too thin-gauged.
Are you sure?
SEAL training, my friend. They teach us how a building is put together so we better understand how to blow it up. That's a false wall in there, and behind it is a 3-foot void.
What the hell for?
Let's find out. They returned inside the sweltering warehouse. Link pulled a matte finish folding knife from his pack. He flipped open the blade and rammed it into the metal siding, cutting the thin steel as if it were paper. He wrenched down on the blade, slicing a long gash nearly to the floor. Then he cut across the tear, sawing the blade back and forth with a sound that set Cabrillo's teeth on edge. Emerson CQC-7A, Link said, holding the knife proudly. There wasn't a mark on the blade. Read about them a few years ago and didn't believe the hype.
I do now.
He kicked at the torn metal, peeling back the siding like the petals of a flower until he could step into the secret room. The beam of his flashlight revealed
nothing. It's empty.
Just like the rest of this place, Link said with obvious disappointment.
Damn.
Together they walked the width of the building in the tight space, sweeping their lights over every surface just to be sure. The heat was horrendous, like standing beside a crucible in a steel mill. Link had his light pointed at the floor when something caught his attention. He stooped, brushing his fingers lightly across the painted concrete. There was a grin on his face when he looked up at the chairman.
What have you got?
This concrete is new. Not the whole floor, just this section. Juan noticed it too. An area about 10 feet long and the full width of the secret chamber was much smoother than the rest and showed no signs of weathering.
"What do you think?" Juan asked.
"Perfect place for a stairwell to a basement level. The size is right."
"Let's find out."
Juan rummaged through his pack for the block of C4 plastic explosives. He molded it to direct its detonative force downward and inserted the timer pencil. A quick glance at Link to make sure he was ready, and Cabrillo activated the detonator. They dashed out of the hidden room and sprinted across the warehouse floor, their lungs sucking in the overheated air and their footfalls echoing. Link flew through the door with Cabrillo at his heels, and they ran for another 50 yards before they slowed and turned. The explosion was a muted crump that blew the skylight panels off the roof and filled the warehouse with a roiling fog of concrete dust. Dust coiled through the damaged roof, making the building look like it was burning. Waiting for the cloud to settle, Juan felt a vague apprehension creeping up his spine, so he carefully scanned the jungle. The glint of sunlight off a reflective surface was all the warning he needed. He shoved Link aside and dove to the ground as a pair of bullets from 2 separate rifles split the air where they had been standing a microsecond earlier. The well-hidden gunmen switched their weapons to automatic and sent a devastating wall of fire into the parking lot where they believed Cabrillo and Link were pinned. The two men were hopelessly outgunned, and if they didn't find cover, they would be dead in the next few seconds. Without needing to communicate, they sprinted back into the warehouse, their legs peppered by bits of gravel thrown up by the bullets that stitched the ground in their wake. Juan was the first to reach the blast site. The concrete had been shattered by the plastique, leaving a large crater in the floor that reeked of the explosive. But it hadn't been enough. The plug was too thick for the amount of plastique they'd brought. Casting his flashlight over the bottom of the crater, he couldn't see a single spot where they had breached all the way through. Defeat was a bitter taste on the tip of his tongue. A constellation of bullet holes appeared in the metal wall of the building. He whirled, not realizing he'd already drawn his Kel-Tec. 2 gunmen stood on either side of the door. He fired 3 covering shots, the range far beyond the gun's capabilities. Neither man flinched. Link jumped past him, landing in the bottom of the crater they'd created. When his feet hit the stressed cement, a hole opened up beneath him and he vanished into the earth. His weight had been enough to cause the plug to give way. As more and more concrete splintered and tumbled down a flight of stairs, Juan tossed himself into the darkened hole, noting that the breeze blowing up from the depths carried the cold stench of death.